Great Hunters, a sci-fi space opera, written by Gary Kaufman, read and produced by Andrew Kaufman. For more information about the author, book, or podcast, visit www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Greetings, everyone. Welcome back to the Great Hunters Podcast. I am Andrew Kaufman, your host, and we have a large hunk of audio for you today. 5 meaty chapters of plot coming at you. So we're going to go ahead and get started with episode 3. But first, here is the story so far. Mike, the alien exobiologist from the far distant planet of Erdiu, has been studying the planet Earth for the past 25,000 years. He has seen a huge amount of life develop, but none more rapidly than humankind. In his time near Earth, he has seen humans go from a few nomadic, primitive hunters and gatherers to a massive industrial species, capable of the kindest of actions and some of the most horrific of deeds. He has read about other races on other planets that had begun this way, and knows that, without a massive societal change, the humans were more than likely on the way to mass destruction, either by war or environmental damage. Using some automatic drones, he has mapped the human genome and discovered a small gene in the human males that controls aggression and tribalism. If it was tamped down, it could enable their society to become more peaceful and careful about some things. But Mike's own society had a big law about interfering in other species' development, the no-contact rule. So he knew that he shouldn't even say hello, let alone change the human males to be less aggressive. But he had grown fond of the humans, and his need to help was rapidly overwhelming his desire to follow his society's laws about making contact. Meanwhile, an eccentric, brilliant, tech-savvy investor and polymath named Warren Mathias has become enamored of some of the genetics tools that are out there, especially CRISPR-Cas9. With his knack for seeing something special in new things, he knew that genetic engineering was going to be the next big thing, once the stigma wore off. So, he has started his own genetics engineering firm called the Mathias Institute, and he wants to staff it with some top-drawer geneticists and have them put as much of their focus on human germline engineering, a relatively forbidden field of research that Mathias knew would eventually lose its stigma. Working closely with a few headhunters and a human resources consultant named Greg Black, he set about recruiting his star team. Chapter 6. The Drive. Greg looked through the open door of the second office on the left. It was a corner office with windows overlooking the woods. He saw Mr. Mathias seated behind an old-fashioned, walnut executive desk. Mathias looked up, waved for Greg to come in, and pointed to a brown leather armchair in front of his desk. Mathias was short and stocky, with bright blue eyes, a halo of white hair around the sides of his otherwise bald head, and a smile Greg thought both friendly and mischievous. Greg said, "Your building looks finished."
"Almost. Just a little wiring and a lot of painting."
"Here the opening is in 3 weeks."
"Building will be ready. What I need now are people."
"I'm ready to start if you are."
"I have a couple dozen resumes for the key positions, and I'll give them to you. But first, I want you to take a drive with me."
Greg asked, "A drive?"
"I know it's unusual, but I want to show you something," said Mathias.
They left the Institute and walked to the silver town car in the parking lot.
"Hop in,"
said Mathias. Greg got in the passenger side. The seats were dark burgundy leather, and the matching burgundy interior was immaculate. Mathias slid into the driver's seat and turned the ignition key. Greg heard a deep rumble as the engine came to life.
"This doesn't sound like a town car," Greg said.
As he buckled his seatbelt, Mathias told him,
"I've made some modifications."
Mathias turned out of the parking lot and drove down the Institute's winding drive. Greg felt none of the usual Lincoln soft ride and body sway. He said,
"You've tuned the suspension, too.
You know cars."
"I grew up in West Virginia. Friends and I used to do some racing."
Mathias turned right on State Highway 13
a mostly straight, four-lane road with little traffic. He said,
"This may take a while. I'm looking for something."
They made small talk while Matthias drove through the countryside. After several minutes, they pulled up at a stoplight beside a bright red Mustang. The badge on the side of the Mustang read, GT350R, one of Ford's street racers. Matthias leaned forward, looked at the other driver, and revved his engine. The Mustang's driver, a large man with full beard and John Deere baseball cap, looked back at Matthias and revved the Mustang's engine. Matthias gave him a nod.
"Hang on, Greg. I think you'll appreciate this."
Matthias had his left foot firmly on the brake and his right foot lightly pressing the throttle. The Lincoln vibrated in anticipation of freedom. When the light turned green, Matthias pulled his left foot off the brake and pushed the gas pedal to the floor. The big Lincoln leapt forward, and the acceleration shoved Greg back in his seat. The engine noise quickly progressed from a deep growl to a high-pitched scream, and the Mustang fell steadily behind. Greg looked at the tachometer, and it read 11,000 RPMs. He knew a Ferrari's red line was about 8,500 RPMs. 11,000 belonged in an Indy race car. He glanced over at Matthias and saw a big grin on his face. Then Greg checked the speedometer. The needle was at 120 and climbing. He looked ahead and saw the road curving to the right. Involuntarily, Greg pushed his left foot to the floor and grabbed the armrest with his right hand. Matthias hit the brakes hard. Then, while they were still moving, he turned the steering wheel sharply to the right. The silver Lincoln went into a slide, gracefully turning clockwise a full 180 degrees before coming to a stop. Now, they were facing back in the direction from whence they'd come. Greg took a deep breath. His heart was pounding, and his hands shook. Matthias got out as the Mustang arrived. The bearded man also got out of his car.
"Damn, old man. What you got in that Lincoln?"
Matthias smiled.
"Trade secret, but thanks for the run. Come back at me if you can find a decent car."
Big man shook his head.
"I can't get what you got in a showroom."
He tipped his hat, ducked back into the Mustang, and drove away. As Matthias got back in his car, Greg said,
"Nice car." "Thanks, Greg, but I didn't bring you out here to get a compliment. I wanted you to see for yourself the kind of person I am."
Matthias turned the key. The Lincoln growled back to life, and they started back to the Institute. Silent for a while, Greg finally said,
"Yes, sir. You like competition. You're determined to win, and you don't mind taking risks."
Matthias gave Greg a nod. As the two entered the office, Gloria said,
"Did you take Mr. Black for a ride?"
Matthias nodded yes. Gloria said,
"Mr. Black, may I offer you a drink? Maybe some whiskey?"
Greg was surprised, but realized that whiskey is precisely what he wanted.
"Please."
Matthias sat behind his desk, and Greg returned to the leather armchair. Gloria brought in a water glass that held 2 inches of amber liquid. Greg downed the whiskey in 2 swallows. After his throat stopped burning, he said in a hoarse voice,
"Okay, ready."
Matthias lifted a green file box and set it on his desk.
"I have 24 candidates for 4 positions, a laboratory manager and 3 geneticists. Your job is to evaluate the candidates, check resumes, get transcripts, call references, do whatever you need to do to find the top 2 prospects for each position. When you're done, I'll interview them."
Greg pulled a legal pad from his brown leather briefcase.
"Tell me more about what you're looking for. Start with the lab manager."
Matthias leaned forward and folded his hands on his desk.
"For the lab manager, the first thing I want is proven leadership talent. Interpersonal skills, organizational ability, great communication skills, the whole package. A bad choice here will poison everything. Second, I want this person to have good technical skills. They don't have to be world-class, but at least good enough to understand what's happening. And finally, I want a winning attitude."
"What do you mean by that?"
"Genuine emotional commitment and the willingness to take risks to get big things done."
"How about the 3 geneticists?
asked Greg.
I need top-quality technical skills. PhDs from good schools with strong genetics programs. There's only going to be 3 of them, so I can't afford any second-raters. And I want a mix of personalities. It won't work to have 3 prima donnas. They have to get along. Here's the mix that I'd like. First, I want a workhorse who's been in the business for a while and knows how discoveries are made. Next, I want a project manager who can complete projects on time and under budget. And finally, I need a genius with world-class brains and creativity. Someone who makes other PhDs look dumb. Greg, you know what I want to do with this business. Right now, engineering the human germline is prohibited. But in the future, it is going to be mainstream. We're going to be the pioneers, and I need people who want to achieve great things more than they want to follow the rules.
Yes, sir. Greg put his legal pad back in his briefcase and picked up the box of resumes. Give me 3 weeks, and I'll be back with the top 2 candidates for each position. Chapter 7. Staffing the Institute. 3 weeks later, Greg returned to the Institute. He opened the Institute's door and said,
Good morning, Mrs. Morris.
Good morning, Mr. Black. Go on in.
Greg walked into Matthias's office. Matthias looked up.
Hi, Greg. Sit down and show me what you have.
Greg pulled 8 manila folders from his briefcase and handed them to Matthias.
I've researched these candidates in every way I can think of. I even hired a private investigator to help me. Then, I ranked the candidates against your requirements. Here's the top 2 for each of the 4 jobs.
Thanks, Greg. I'll take it from here.
There's one other thing.
What's that?
If you're happy with the candidates, I'd like to ask a favor.
Matthias raised his eyebrows.
Let me drive your Lincoln?
Matthias smiled.
Deal.
As soon as Greg left, Matthias began looking through the folders. An hour later, he asked Gloria to come into his office.
Gloria, next week I want to interview 8 candidates.
He handed her the 8 folders.
Here are their resumes and phone numbers. Schedule 2 interviews a day, Monday through Thursday. Leave Friday open. Interviews should take 2 hours. Schedule 1 for 10 in the morning, 1 for 2 in the afternoon.
Matthias finished his last interview on Thursday afternoon. And on Friday, he called Greg to ask a few follow-up questions. Then he laid out the 8 resumes on his desk and made his selections. Laboratory manager, Jane Parker. Doctorate in genetics from Yale. 10 years of experience at Johnson & Johnson. First as a researcher, then as a lab supervisor for the last 7 years. Her employees say she's an excellent supervisor. However, she has been passed over for promotion 2. Her boss said she's a great leader, but she's also independent, sometimes to the point of insubordination. In her personal life, she is an environmental activist and a prominent member of Greenpeace. She also has a significant police record, having been arrested 14 times for civil disobedience in support of environmental issues. Workhorse, Arthur Brown. Doctorate in genetics from MIT, 27 years experience as a research scientist for the National Institutes of Health. He's the author and co-author of 65 publications in scientific journals. His boss says he's one of the best researchers at the NIH, but he's uninterested in becoming a supervisor. Coworkers say he's easy to work with, but is very uncomfortable with conflict. In his personal life, he enjoys backpacking in remote places. Project manager, Walter Bennett. Doctorate in genetics from USC San Diego and 6 years experience as a project manager for Genentech's product development division. His boss at Genentech said he has outstanding project management skills. He's driven, focused, and consistently meets project deadlines and budgets. However, he can be blunt, and his achievements occasionally come at the expense of consideration and tact. In his personal life, Walt is a practicing Mormon and enjoys outdoor photography and scuba diving. Genius, Sarah Merchant, finalist in Google's 2020 Science Fair competition, and youngest PhD in the history of UC Berkeley's genetics department. Her dissertation on the genetic basis of chimpanzee intelligence was published in the journal Science. Her major professor says she's brilliant and ambitious, but he warned that if success does not come quickly, she gets frustrated and depressed. In her personal life, Sarah enjoys co-ed volleyball. Chapter 8.
6 months later. At 10:30 Monday morning, Jane Parker, Research and Development Manager for the Matthias Institute, threw open the door to the second-floor genetics lab and strode in. Jane was not a big person. Petite would be a more accurate description. But her intense personality made her seem larger. Jet-black hair framed an angular face with high cheekbones, and she had quick brown eyes that seemed to notice every detail. Jane had never married. Her mother told her that she scared men away, and this was certainly true for the insecure.
"Spend the weekend in jail again?" Art asked.
"Damn right," snapped Jane, "and I'll keep doing it until those bastards wake up. Climate change is real. We are killing ourselves."
Taken back by her intensity, Art retreated to the safety of his computer screen. He was the oldest and most experienced of the four geneticists, and 30 centimeters taller than Jane. But even after 6 months of working together, Jane still intimidated him. Her emotional intensity made him anxious. He didn't blame Jane. He'd been in therapy, and he knew what was going on. When Art was in the first grade, his father, a heavy drinker, had lost his sales job and quickly descended into alcoholism. His mother, who suffered severe pain from a herniated disc in her neck, became addicted to oxycodone. As a result, much of Art's early life, until he moved in with his grandparents, was chaos punctuated by screaming arguments. Art protected himself as best he could. When a fight broke out, he fled to his bedroom, closed the door, and hid in his books.
"I don't know how you do it, Jane. I'd be scared to death to go to jail."
In contrast to Jane, Sarah was tall with long blonde hair, cheerleader good looks, and a warm, outgoing personality. While looking for a job, Sarah declined offers from Harvard and multi-billion-dollar drug company to accept a job at the Matthias Institute. Mr. Matthias paid well, but the real reason why she chose his small laboratory was for the opportunity to research the human germline. Other geneticists were not exploring this area, and she thought the Matthias Institute offered her the quickest way to make a name for herself. Walt said,
"Once, I protested at the Los Alamos Weapons Lab. 10 other Mormons and I blocked the main gate in."
Walt was as tall as Art, but where Art was thin, balding, and looked like a middle-aged college professor, Walt looked like a basketball player. Broad shoulders, long arms and legs, big hands, and a full head of curly, dark brown hair.
"What happened?"
Sarah asked.
"Cops arrested us, put us in handcuffs, and took us to jail. They let us out the next day. And you know what happened? We got a one-paragraph story on the back page of the Los Alamos News. That was all. One freaking paragraph. And it didn't change anything."
"Sometimes," Jane said, looking at Walt, "it seems like nothing will happen. But one thing's for certain. Sitting around complaining never changed anything. If you want to make a difference, you have to act."
Chapter 9. Girl Talk. Sarah was in her first professional job. She was 3,000 miles from home, and she missed her mother. She was also a young woman trying to make her way in a male-dominated profession. To Jane, this was a familiar scenario, and she empathized with Sarah. Within a week, Sarah and Jane had bonded. Sarah shared her ambitions and insecurities with Jane, and Jane told her about her struggles at Johnson & Johnson. One day, while they were drinking coffee and waiting for a DNA sequencer to display the results of an analysis, Jane leaned towards Sarah and said, in a quiet voice,
"We'd be better off without men."
Sarah, who had started dating Walt, looked surprised. Then she said,
"Well, maybe some things."
Jane laughed.
"I know what you mean, but apart from that, so many of our problems come straight from humans with a Y chromosome."
"Like war?"
"Not just war. Which gender is responsible for every financial crash in history? Which gender is responsible for denying climate change and blowing the tops off mountains for coal? Which gender is responsible for hunting animals to extinction? The rhinos are nearly extinct because men in China think eating a rhino's horn will give them a bigger erection. This is what men do."
Sarah added,
Men invent religions that make women subservient and prohibit birth control. I could create a plague just for men and wipe them all off the face of the earth. How about reproduction? Sperm banks.
Sir said.
You're talking about killing half the human race.
I am, but think about it. Men are going to kill us all. Just then, Art and Walt walked back into the lab. Seeing the two women engaged in a serious conversation, Art said, Hey, ladies, what's going on? Sarah smiled.
Oh, nothing. Just girl talk.
Chapter 10 Humans 25 millennia of observing, cataloging, and documenting might seem tedious. It was slow, even for Mike. Fortunately, he had automated most of the cataloging, allowing him to study humans in depth. In his private notebook, he wrote, Humans are small, bipedal mammals with limited physical talents. Slow of foot, modest strength, limited reproductive capability. Small mouth, tiny teeth, no claws, no armor, no fur. In short, humans are ill-adapted for any but the most benign environments. And they are an infant species. In their most recent genotype, they are no more than 180,000 years old. I'm surprised they survived, but in an amazingly short time, less than my lifespan, humans evolved from hiding in caves to becoming the dominant species on the planet. They have settled nearly every corner of the Earth and built massive, sprawling cities. They've even achieved space travel. Ironically, this primitive, backwoods planet turned out to be a developmental dynamo. The speed of human development is something I have considered at length. Like most social species, they readily form into tribes and cooperate to get what they need. This has allowed them to become predators instead of prey. I have seen four males in a tiny boat made from a hollowed-out log stalk and kill an enormous marine mammal that they call a whale. They're also intelligent, but their intelligence is not my species' logical, steady intelligence. It's emotionally driven. Unfortunately, the emotion that too often drives a male's intelligence is aggression. They devote enormous resources to competition. Nations war with each other. Political parties battle endlessly for power, and businesses and sports teams compete as if the stakes were life or death. Humans' hyper-aggressive nature has resulted in an enormous waste of lives and resources, but it has produced amazing progress in one area. I can scarcely keep up with the blur of their scientific advances. The time between their first powered flight and the first venture into space was only 54 years. I've hibernated longer than that. Thousands of artificial satellites now orbit the planet. They have sent human explorers to land on their moon and robot explorers to other planets. Unfortunately, the humans are on a path to self-destruction. The traits responsible for their success are the same traits propelling them to extinction. This isn't unique. Exobiologists have documented several species that have managed to destroy their home world through tribalism and aggression-driven intelligence. On a personal note, and somewhat to my embarrassment, I have become attached to the humans. Garwick warned me not to get involved, but humans are the most interesting species on the planet. I've spent more time than I should observing their popular culture. My files contain copies of every Star Trek episode. As incredible as it might seem, Star Trek's prime directive, do not interfere with the internal and natural development of alien civilizations, is nearly identical to the exobiologists' no-contact rule. It's not just their popular culture that fascinates me. I am astounded at the humans' willingness to tinker with the fabric of their society. In the last 1,100 years, they have frequently experimented with their government and economic systems. Feudalism, monarchy,
theocracy, dictatorship, socialism, capitalism, communism, democracy. For someone from Erdiu, a world that prides itself on stability and tradition, humanity is a fast-paced action drama. I keep hoping a new leader will appear and guide them towards a more stable, less destructive future.
And that was Episode 3. I must sincerely apologize for the delay between Episodes 2 and 3, but life and other plans did get in the way. Not much of an excuse, but it's all I got. Anyway, what did you think of the full intro to Mr. Mathias and his business model? He does seem to have a little Elon-ness in him, but I can definitely assure you that he is not. And as for the people that work for him, well, we haven't seen much yet, nor even how they will develop over time, but they will definitely be taking some turns as the story moves forward. Walt and Sarah seem to be starting off all right, and Jane is definitely not someone that you want to be on the receiving end of a verbal lashing that we all know she can deliver. And as for Art, while he is certainly capable, his meekness is rather inhibitive, but he does change, and fairly soon. So keep an eye out for him in the future. I'll have the advertisement links and such out fairly soon. Time has recently expanded for me, so I will be able to put the proper attention to getting the business side of things going. Episode 4 will be out in the next few weeks, so be on the lookout for it pretty soon. I'll send out some alerts as soon as I can. So until then, farewell.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about the show, you have many ways to do so. You can send your feedback in text or audio to thegreathuntersnovel@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to read them or play them before the credits. You can also submit it to the website at www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Facebook page for the podcast and myself is www.facebook.com/performer.andrew.kaufman. If you like the book, please leave a review at Apple Podcasts and or podchaser.com. It really helps people to find the show. That's all for now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. The book is copywritten 2024 by Gary Kaufman. The intro song is Jet Fueled Vixen by Kevin MacLeod from incompetech.com and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. The outro song is Stay the Course, also by Kevin MacLeod from incompetech.com, and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. The contents of this podcast are copywritten 2024 by Andrew Kaufman and is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, so don't change or sell it, but you can share it all you want. For more information about these licenses, please visit creativecommons.org.